September 30, 2017 is officially Tiger Time.
We never reconcile.
Oh, that last one. 27
years and the Tigers are like king. The Tiger of old. The storm and the bones of the Tiger.
And welcome back to a very special episode of Richmond Tiger Talk. We're joined by a guest, George Megalogenis. Welcome, George.
Thank you, Nick. How are you?
Very well. And look, you've done a few interviews this week, but I think this is the very first interview that takes the premise of your new book, the wonderfully titled How Richmond's Premiership Can Save Australia. And for this podcast, you've got an entire audience that just thinks that's the most sensible premise that's ever been invented.
Brilliant.
I'm very interested, look, both in your journey as a Richmond supporter, but also the journey of this book, because it seems a wonderful way of combining your professional career in interest in politics with your very personal passion for the Richmond Football Club. And I think we should all be trying to have more of that type of melding of interests and passions in our lives.
Yeah, the public and private come together in an unexpected way. Mm. Because the 2017 Grand Final was such an epic occasion, social, communal occasion, and the energy in and around Melbourne and around the country, pubs, backyards, living rooms, was actually felt globally. Because did you notice that story was carried on a lot of the international networks? It wasn't just the romance of the drought breaking. It was the images of, you know, Swan Street erupting, the MCG erupting, Brendan Garland, Peggy O'Neill. Well, Brendan teared up. I don't think Peggy teared up. She was a little more stoic than he was.
Typically so.
So the thing did, it did go beyond the containment line of our tribe, the mighty Richmond Tigers. And for me, it meant that there was clearly a bigger story there. Because the journalist in you says, you can't have all these people thinking the same thing at once and it just being an accident. But the interesting thing about putting a book together like this, I thought the easy book would be just the celebration, like a love letter to your team. And I assumed a lot of people who shared my passion would want to read that book. But what Richmond did was remarkable. And what is happening in the rest of Australia is remarkable in other ways. A lot of unremarkable people have power at the moment, and they're doing a lot of, I wouldn't say terrible things, they're sort of missing opportunities, I think, set us up for the future. And this accident, and this is the accident that all data nerds, you know, you keep drawing these little graphs up. I'll tell you about a couple of graphs I was drawing about. But I wanted a baseline for the story. I wanted to figure out why so many people went crazy in 2017, and could I find an echo from the past? And the street parties, the equivalent street parties, were thrown when Richmond won its first premiership in the VFL in 1920, and certainly by the time it had won its fourth in that era at the bottom of the Depression in 1934. And those street parties have an echo in 2018. And of course, within the bubble of the white Australia, when we're not receiving too many people and the tariff wall is well and truly up, and a suburb like Richmond in the 20s and 30s was almost isolated. Even isolated from its own neighbour.
Struggle town.
One of the highest unemployment rates during the Depression and most successful on-field football team at the time. I was looking at those little correlations. I was looking at attendances, and I just wanted to have sort of statistical baseline. So when I mouthed off about all the other things I wanted to write about, at least I had a number or two I could point to. But by the time I got to the early 80s, and we started to blow up routinely, a model that may have worked in the 60s and 70s suddenly looked ridiculous, out of time by the early 80s, when they're starting to spin the revolving door. And I counted up the number of coaches we were losing in 5-6 year blocks. And on average, we're losing a coach every second year. From the moment they got rid of Tom Hafe in 1976 until the turn of the 21st century, you'd have to take your shoes off to count all the coaches, I think. And it wasn't a light bulb moment, but I was looking at it and thinking, can I? Yes, I can. The 80s especially, at Tigerland looks like the federal political scene today. And for those of us who are invested in our footy and keep an eye on the politics, you go, sure, I hadn't thought of that, but that's obvious. To the third reader, which is maybe not necessarily the footy reader or the political reader, or maybe the political reader doesn't understand the footy, it's actually a terrific analogy. And it's a gentle way of telling the political class today, because I think they're sick of people like me telling them, you know, the Giants once walked the earth, or Keating, Howard, that the country used to be run well, that politics was conducted not perfectly, but sort of better than it is today. And what Richmond did then is what you're doing today, point one. But point two, what Richmond did to win the premiership in 2017 looks more like the sort of things you would want to be thinking about in the 21st century if you wanted to hit the big reset button and reconnected your polity to your community.
That was one of the parts of your book that really struck me, and I have spent some time since trying to think about, well, how many news polls in a row was losing three finals?
I think it felt like 3,000, didn't it?
It felt like a lot, but it does, when you put it in that context, the decision to stick with Hardwick does seem extraordinary when you see what the leadership cycle has become.
Let's remind ourselves, in 2010, Labor was still in front of that news poll when they rolled Rudd, but essentially what happened to Rudd was the approval rating, which was in the 60s and 70s, for most of that 2008-2009 period, it came off a fair way once the transaction on climate change revealed him as yet another politician, and the electorate recoiled from the sort of, you know, the sense that they'd been conned, that they thought he was fresh thinker, Kevin 07, new kind of politics, we've got a nerd in the lodge, and none of that old transactional rubbish. This man is going to be speaking from the heart and speaking from the advice book. So he's going to take all the advice seriously. Suddenly he looks like another politician. The Labor Party obviously went into a bit of a panic, but they were behind. I think only in a couple of polls. And then, of course, once you get rid of him, as they did, they found the transactional cost of changing leaders punitive. Now, Brendan Gale reminded me, and I sort of reminded him, but he reminded me more because he lived through it. Through the 90s, when they were having a coach every other year, you know, after Northie walked to the Brisbane, they were then the Lions, they're still the Bears and they're about to become the Lions. When he walked at the end of that 95 season, he said, most of us were in our early to mid-20s, and we'd just gotten used to playing for this guy, and we loved this guy. New coach comes in, new game plan, new sets of favourites, new sets of players on the outer. Some of us, as we're developing our game, got some issues we may need to address. And if you'd iron those issues out, we become a premiership team. But now some of those things get swept under the carpet because the new broom has come in. And then 2 years later, he's gone. And then another one's gone a year and a half later. And before you know it, a career has passed for a lot of these guys. And they do remind me of essentially that generation of Labor and now Liberal. Essentially, the entire political class have now gone through the ringer twice. 6 years for Labor. I mean, the coalition is not looking that crash hot at the moment. But yeah, take it back to the observation about what you would do at the end of 2016 even. So the first three finals, you might forgive the first one. The second one, you might have said, okay, nine in a row, got us into a final, and we were cooked by the time we went to Port Adelaide. That third final was probably, in my adult life, the single most miserable afternoon I've spent.
There's been a few.
Yeah, but that one in particular, because I think the expectations were pretty high that day. And lose the plot all the way through 2016. So yes, it is a number of news polls in a row. Not only is it a number of news polls in a row, the trend line is well and truly established now. And it looks like from here on, not just that the coach lost the plot, the membership was up in arms. We knew that a couple of coups were coming. And some senior players, Delidio obviously leaves. Jack must have been, Rewalt must have been thinking about it. Rance would probably be thinking about it. I know Jack Riewoldt, I did pick up a quote in the sort of aftermath of 2017 where he said he'd sort of resigned himself at some point in 2016 to never playing in a premiership team.
Yeah, I thought that came out at the end of the GWS final. His face of it.
Yeah.
Actually, the two people that struck me at the end of that final was him and Delidio for opposite reasons.
For opposite reasons,
the release of emotion. And the thought, you know, I think part of the reason I was so emotional on grand final day was that I'd had the thought that it's possible that Richmond don't win another grand final in my adult lifetime.
And this is when the premiership was approaching.
Yeah.
Whereas the thought the previous year would have been, maybe we need to give up on this thing at some point. Maybe we need to grow up. So here's the question that I've been pondering, and I did spend a bit of time with Brendan Gale and Peggy O'Neill. We're going to talk about Damien Hardwick in a sec because he didn't want to do an interview for the record. I did get to catch up with him, but he didn't want to do an interview for the record. But Brendan and Peggy through 2016, I had a little bit to do with them because towards the end of that season, some of those president's functions are half empty, and there was one particular game late in the season against St Kilda. Peggy invited Christos Tsokas and myself to get up on stage for a couple of minutes and say hi. And then she introduced me, and then I did a quick question and answer for Christos when we talked basically about his childhood as a Tiger, you know, the glory days. And he had this great line. He said there were sort of three icons in his house. He grew up in a very Labour household. There was the Virgin Mary, there was Gough Whitlam, and there was Kevin Bartlett. They were his big three growing up. But late that year, remember the review was already underway?
Yeah.
And this is before the plotters had declared their hand, before Bruce Monteith and Brian Wood, for example, have aligned themselves with one of the alternate tickets. I got the sense from both Brendan and Peggy that they were, A, very disappointed with the season that was unfolding, and then it had not yet come to its sort of calamitous denouement with the Sydney Swans game. But we'd already been to the GWS game. Mm. So, yeah, Canberra listeners who were there that day, there was probably a period for about a quarter and a half, and it looked like, not that they couldn't score, but a Richmond player literally couldn't get their hands anywhere near the football to interfere with its trajectory from one GWS player to another. But I got the impression that they had very much earlier in the season figured out that they needed to reanalyse where they were going. But she declared afterwards, and this is not in 2016, this is subsequent interviews, and you wonder with the hindsight of success whether it's easier to let these stories out and whether you would even have understood this at the time if we hadn't won the premiership. She said when they extended his contract by the extra 2 years, most people were saying, you haven't won a final yet, give him a single year. They sat in the boardroom and she explained this, and they said, we go for 1 year, we're going to be talking about this sooner rather than later, and what happens if the wheels fall off? So we're going for two. Then the next question was, if we go for two, there's a chance in any one of those 2 years we might go backwards. What are we going to do then? And they all committed around the table. This is really good. This is really good governance. Every single person around the boardroom table said, we'll stick with him. This is ahead of the worst case capitulation scenario, which was the title of that 2016 season. So bring it back to that particular occasion late in the season, that St Kilda game, which was the most turgid game I think I would have seen to that point. So neither club was invested in the result. So they're both playing Richmond-style footy. Very few goals were kicked. Although I do remember the last 30 seconds or so, for some reason, Cochin went straight down the centre and a goal was scored. And I thought, you could have been doing this any time this year. What happened? I think they were pretty clear about what they were going to do. And then they were ready when the media said, let's chop some heads off. They were ready when the plotting started. They were ready when the next loss came. And it's quite liberating when you've got... I think when you've got an orderly process and then the crap starts flying in your direction, it's quite liberating to be able to say to everybody, let's just wait until we finish this review. I'm already on the case. So thinking of a political analogy, and the best one I can think of, so holding on to Hardwick when they did, turning over the assistant coaches, bringing in some fresh thinking, holding the mirror up to people like Damien and saying, you know, the reason why we hired you as coach was we thought that you bring the following skills. We know that you're going to grow into a great coach. Some of the things that you've got in your private life, you're not bringing here to your job this year. You're getting a bit cranky. You're removing yourself from the players. You're trying to do it all by yourself. Drowning yourself in deeds are. Take a break. You've got your job. We're not going to lose you. We love you. But take a break and come back. And you've reset for us. And of course, he, to his credit, I think he was starting to figure some of these things out. Now, the political analogy that I will draw, and I didn't do it in the book because you sort of didn't want to overload the book with and then this happened in the political sphere. I'd much rather say, and then we won another premiership. So I'd much rather the narrative tilt more to the footy than the politics. The politics is sort of a lighter touch, but the lessons are quite valuable. Through 97 and 98, most of those news polls had John Howard behind and the coalition behind. And the big disruptor then was obviously the arrival of Pauline Hanson. Two things were going on at once. Hanson sets up the One Nation Party and peels off primary vote from the Liberal column and quite in a volatile sense parks it in her party. Never going to win a seat in the federal election in the lower house, but it's the transfer of the leakage of preferences back to Labor that make it diabolical for a Conservative Party, because her party only exists in their safe seats, and in their marginal seats there's literally no conversation at all in the southeast cosmopolitan corner where Labor's vote is still relatively strong. But the other thing that happened in those days was that Cheryl Curnow turns up. So some of that middle ground Liberal voter that was Australian Democrat switches to Labor as well. Now, the Liberal Party could have gone one of two ways in 97 and 98. They could have decided to tough it out and, you know, keep hitting reset button until they came up with tax reform, which is what they did, or they could have got rid of the leader.
Mm.
And if they'd got rid of the leader, they would have been a one-term government.
Mm.
I think guaranteed they would have been a one-term government then. Now, they came to those decisions in those days because the instinct in the governing class, and by governing class I mean, you know, the incumbent doesn't easily give up its prime minister in the first term. And it hadn't really been done. I don't count the sort of Gorton.
You don't count Bruce.
you could count Bruce, but I wouldn't count the Gordon McMahon one, for example, because that's the tail end of a very, very long incumbency. And when Bruce was a third termer, by the time he lost his seat, a different issue.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah, yeah.
I suppose he was the last one to lose his seat.
He was the last one to lose his seat, but Howard doesn't lose his seat until 2007. I'm thinking 97, 98. Yeah. So this is sort of Walls-Geishan era for the Tigers. no one was looking to Richmond in those days for advice on what to do to the leader.
Only a cautionary tale.
So they, not only did they end up winning an election, having gone through that thing, they're a little more confident as a governing unit. So the cabinet was much tighter, having gone through this thing. And they would look around the cabinet table and know that a year ago we might have been thinking about knocking the leader off, but now we know we should be waiting these things out. The Labor people in that area would explain, you know, when they've taken pot shots at the Liberals, like, in our day, and this is Hawke and Keating, in our day, the first 2 years were right off in terms of the polls anyway, because we were governing in the first 2 years. It's year three of an election cycle where you're sort of batting down you sort of get rid of all the, scrape off all the barnacles and then go into electioneering mode, which is you're in giveaway mode. So, you know, so you tighten all your levers in the first 2 years, you get your budget balanced, and then you spend in the third year and then you get re-elected. So that, the idea that a three-year term could be thought out that way, was normal then. It's not normal now. Now you almost hit even the day after re-election, you know, the first poll on the field will probably have a bit of a bounce. A couple of polls later, you trial a balloon on a particular issue, the opposition is suddenly happy to go to work again because their vote spiked and the government's vote has collapsed. That is obviously cultural now, as structural issue as well, because of the disruption of media. I find thinking through how footy had to unlearn these old semi-professional habits of, you know, the Graham Richmond habit of knocking off the coach every year, how Richmond had to unlearn all that.
Well, you mentioned about Brendan and Penny, but they did that. They had the five-year plan, the mocked five-year plan.
Yes.
With financial stability, making finals, and sort of a number of steps along the way. So there's sort of the process for unlearning bad habits started well before the winning did.
And I think that's the that's why I spend more time thinking about them in the last third of the book, in the sort of, you know, this is the most journalistic part of the book. It gets emotional again towards the end because we can't stop celebrating the premiership. Premiership is plural, of course.
Last year's premiership.
Yes. That's why I corrected myself then. So their reaction in 2016 wasn't just a gut call.
Mm.
So they put themselves in a position where they could make a decision like that. And they put themselves in a position because when you think about what was going on, even before Brendan Gale arrives as CEO, and this is where Peggy's on the board before she becomes president, because she becomes president a couple of years after Brendan Gale becomes CEO, they have decided collectively, and Brendan is the one who sort of brings this message out publicly because he's the one with the five-year plan, they've decided that the on-field success is directly correlated to the way the club is run.
Mm.
So if you look into finger point, the problem is not necessarily this player, that coach, this game plan, that game plan, the run of the ball, you know, this Matthew Richardson knee reconstruction, that broken jaw, you know, Joel Bowden's shoulder popping out, whatever it is, that isn't what explained Richmond's serial underachievement between 1982. We'll take that as not a bad year. We did lose a premiership. Between 1982 and by then 2009, 2010 when they turn up. We were the only Victorian-based team that didn't make a grand final in that period.
Mm.
We were, you can't count Fitzroy because they were sort of punted out of the competition. Even Fremantle, which was a younger team, one of the youngest interstate teams, had already made a grand final by 2015. We were so far off the charts as a viable proposition. But Brendan had, and I don't know how much of this has come out in other accounts, Brendan had not just the lived experience of the 90s playing, his time at the Players Association, a number of epiphanies for him, I think, as he worked through that job in the Players Association. So he could see clubs on a Monday after a win or a Monday after a loss. He could see what a well-organised club looked like versus a reactive club. And he could sort of like, with a true adult's eyes, look back on his playing career and look back on that club. And I actually think it takes an enormous self-awareness for him to be able to come to the conclusion that the team he played for probably could have won a premiership if the club was better run. So in a way that they don't feel responsible in the end. Once you relieve the player from that burden and you know that your real job is to get your governance right first. And remember, their five-year plan is obviously get themselves out of debt. Reconnect with the members with a much more honest appraisal of what went wrong. And so you're promising hope again, because you're in the hope business anyway in footy. But you're saying...
And politics, yeah.
But we're going to show you incremental improvement for the first few years because we're rebuilding slowly. But we still want you to re-sign. They, even before 2016, let's think about a couple of, you know, sort of character tests. There was, you know, when they sold those games to the Gold Coast, those home games, which
I went to one of them. It's just dreadful.
So that they get $500,000 each for those games. So that $500,000 goes straight into the footy department. And the 4 points, they probably should have won the 4 points anyway. But even if they'd won the 4 points, so let's try the counter scenario. They played those games at home, had a dishonourable win. Bank the 4 points, don't have the $500,000, they don't make the finals anyway that year. This is looking at both sides of the balance sheet and understanding your short-term versus your long-term goals, your immediate needs versus your...
And riding a few bad poles.
Yeah, well, they're riding more than a few bad poles. Poor old Brendan, one of them, I think one of those Gold Coast games might have got a bit hairy for a few of the officials as they're walking out of the ground. I think another one he had to, and I do remember this one, I sent him an email beforehand just to just because I figured he would have got 100 saying you're an idiot. So I sent him one saying, you know what you're doing. You're going to have a crap Monday. Mm. And he did. He fronted on the Monday, not just media. Didn't he take field questions, online questions from members after one of those ones? And you can imagine what was coming at the other end of him. You know, I ran an economics blog on The Australian for 5 years, and I know what gets posted that never goes up. I think that was an unfiltered, you know, what do you call it, a member storm, tweet storm.
It wouldn't have been pretty.
So if they hadn't been thinking that years in advance of 2016, there's no way they would have passed it. 2016 is a stress test or a character test. There's no way they would have passed that. There would have been a period early in 2007, and once they started losing those games by, you know, after the sign, you know, there would have been a point where they thought that we made the wrong decision, but I don't think they thought that. I think they had thought a lot about it well before that season. And by the time you were tested that year, 2016, that 2016 is like John Howard's 1997, 98. That 2016 is like Bob Hawke's 1986, during the Banana Republic period. But there was a mini recession that year. It wasn't an actual deep recession, but you know, the business cycle was turning south and the government was behind. It was also Bob Hawke's 88 when they lost a few by-elections at the start of that year. That was Keating's 92. So you have to know what you're doing, and you have to also be the other thing. I think full credit to them that you also have to be prepared to learn from, because you're going to make mistakes along the way anyway. I should let you ask a question at some point. One of the interesting things I found sort of analysing and sort of interrogating and interviewing for the last third of the book, what they did between 2010 and 2016, because by 2017 you're going back to fan mode. So I wanted to be a journo between 2010 and 2016 to understand essentially what they did. They had to unlearn a Richmond way of operating, to learn a new way of running the club, which made them viable in a national competition. The old model worked in the VFL, but wasn't working in the AFL. It wasn't just us, though. Carlton had a similar problem. Mm. Essendon obviously had a similar problem. Hawthorn fell off the cliff for a little while there. And Collingwood, of course, tried to re-bankrupt itself in the early 90s after it sort of got itself out of trouble. Well, late 90s, sorry. A lot of these Victorian teams kept thinking quick fix.
Mm.
Because they're essentially oligarchs in the old competition. And you know, they could buy a player, they could bully the VFL, they could get some rule change, you know, they could get their tribe to turn up and spit at the opposing team, which would happen at Victoria Park and Windy Hill. Think it through. There's a fair bit of big club first mover rights.
Entitlement to success.
Yes. But in the AFL, where there's still nine of you in those days, a shrinking market in Melbourne, and you're going up against the equivalent of state teams, you're getting smashed each time you go over there. In fact, most of our executions followed a game against Adelaide or something, didn't they? Didn't we lose one by? There's one awful one I remember when Robert Walls lost his job. I was still living in Canberra at the time. And I put the video recorder on because the game has been televised later that night, you know, because they only showed it at 11 o'clock or something. And obviously didn't watch the tape, but we lose by 140 points or something.
It was pretty, yeah. And that was, I think that was the start of the calls for the Geesham, and then, you know, the cycle starts again.
Yeah. Peggy O'Neill had an interesting observation about that era. She said, because they kept finishing thereabouts, ninth or whatever, and occasionally would make a final, there was just the tantalising suggestion of success around the corner, and because you could kick, because there would be a bit of a bounce, you know, like from moving from Rudd to Gillard, there was clearly a bounce in the news polls. So you know, Geeshan's first season,
it was a sugar hit.
Yeah, the sugar hit. It's just but of course, you revert to mean in the second year, and you have to get rid of him and go for another one.
Yeah, so I'm quite interested. You were saying about in 2017 you were in fan mode. I'm interested that by the middle of the year that you were convinced that we were going to win a premiership. That's pretty early.
Yeah, mine was pretty early. I think if you've seen even you know a good block of my sort of adulthood as a casual fan, sort of a you know a, almost a lapsed fanatic, you sort of park that side of your life. Mm. A bit in your 20s and 30s. It's a bit of a rite of passage to sort of let go of a few things of your childhood. And
did you miss the Richo era?
I got the tail end of it, and I could see why people were going to watch that guy. And in fact, I think he was the one who brought me back.
Mm.
Absolutely, I think he brought me back. He was good. He was good for 6 wins a year off his own boot. And there are very few players in the history of the game that could lift a mediocre team over the line. And we didn't just beat any old side. I think most of those years, when I was going through the stats, we'd find a way to beat the eventual premier or runner-up. Mm. We'd also find a way that in the same season to lose the Wooden Spooner, hence the ninthment situation that we went through. So why did I think we'd win it? There was something, and I know which game it was. It was the Gold Coast game, and we didn't even have a full forward because Jack had his eye poked out by Chole in training. And without a full forward, we still beat him easily. And this is the Gold Coast, remember? You've gone to one of these games, so you know how. So my head was thinking, if we're not any good this year, this is the sort of game we drop. But I was sort of watching that 8 minutes on the website at the end of the night because I don't have Foxtel, so I didn't watch the game. There was something about the way the look in their eye and the smiles in their faces.
Mm.
Something told me that they were enjoying their footy so much. And I'd seen them do a couple of things earlier in the year. The first game I went to was the Melbourne game, where we looked like we went hopelessly out. The Great Escape. And not only did they get out of it, but what was written on their face was not the shock and relief of having just pulled one out of the fire. It was, we knew we would win this.
Mm.
We never doubted that we wouldn't win this. And I hadn't seen them with that purpose. So that's the emotional observation. The rational observation was it was a very open season. And up until that point, I don't think we'd lost to St Kilda yet, or maybe we had lost to St Kilda. No, we hadn't lost to St Kilda at this point. But up until that point, we were clearly the most consistent team in an open year. Like, we were the least. So the difference between our best and our worst game was the smallest gap I think I'd ever seen. And there was something in the back of my mind that also said, they look like they're ready.
Mm.
And there's no other reason that I thought that, but I didn't think that anybody else was terrific that year. Having picked it, and having, well, I'd made the tip.
Mm.
Would I put money on it? Probably not. I'd gamble anyway. But having picked it and having posted this stupid tweet late one Sunday night, it would have been at the end of the weekend, my Twitter feed lit up not with, you know, people telling me that why didn't I call out so-and-so, or why didn't I stand up for free speech here, or, you know, you bloody Greek socialists, you don't know anything about economics, which you get a lot now in my feed because of post-GFC, from a certain kind of Australian male, but I'm not sure that they're a real person. I think they're just bots hunting out Greek surnames. No, I'm joking. That Twitter feed lit up with a whole lot of people having these conversations with me that were not political, not snippy. Well, people were being smart Alex about it. They were being smart Alex in a way that I remembered conversations when I was a kid about the footy. And I suddenly realised there's a bit of magic around Richmond. It had nothing to do with the tweet.
Mm.
It was actually... So, you know, the vibe of the thing was that, of course, this is possible. And I think the Western Bulldogs experience the previous year made it permissible to even dream of stuff like that. So I don't know, absent of what factor, would a premiership have been unobtainable even if the opportunity arose. I think the club at some point, I think they were slow to click onto the idea that they could win. Neil Barham said he hadn't realised how good we were until the last quarter of the Geelong final. Hardwick, I think, has made the point for the record that it was only in the second last round and they didn't have to kick lots of goals when Jacob Townsend turns up out of nowhere.
Well, the merchandise department were 2 months behind until the new year, so they clearly didn't see
it coming. They weren't ready. There was a line in Conrad Marshall's book where the merchandise department apparently was gearing up for a premiership, but they were 2 months behind. They're still a little behind now. They ordered a few books, you know, for the Tigerland Superstore, and they sold them quickly, which should be a message that maybe you want a few more in there. And I think Conrad might have had the same experience. Mm. No disrespect to the merchandise store. I think around a football club, you have to have almost not a pessimistic mindset. You can't allow yourself to order 100 or 1,000 of something in the expectation of a premiership. You can't send out the email to the members to say, get your bids in for grand final tickets in round 20 or round 21. You just can't think that way. So in a way, I'd excuse them. But in another respect, maybe your operations do need to learn to dial up almost quickly or something.
Well, it was almost a cliche that for a generation it was, well, if Richmond has a period of success, the expectations were always that we would be a big club. I don't think anyone realised it could be 100,000 members big.
Yeah, 100,000 members who I think on average were spending, you know, in the hundreds or the thousands on merchandise. Not every single member, but did you click through the questionnaire the other week?
I did.
Did you notice that there was a, can you tell us how much you spent on merchandise? So I think that they're now starting to scale up.
Mm-hmm.
I think they want to get a feel for what people want to do. Brendan Gale made a very interesting point about why people join now.
Mm.
And they're joining not just for win-loss, although I think they would still like their club to be winning premierships. I think they want their clubs to represent them.
Mm.
And that 100,000 is clearly not 100,000 that are going to go to get game every week. Although I would caution the AFL against this idea that you need to reserve seats for opposing teams at Richmond games, because if you do what ratings bonanzas, you want to recreate through the home and away season the vibe of the GWS preliminary final.
Mm.
So lock out opposition fans. In fact, we may even cut a deal here. For away games, just let Richmond fans fill the stage. And then you may want to handicap us at a home game by, you know, making us pay above odds to actually, so we don't outnumber them at the home game. And then we could test this theory about whether Richmond are any good away. And I think you'll find there's no logic here to what I'm saying, but I'd much rather see a lot of those members turn up every single week. But it's the capacity constraints.
I know. I'm
pretty obvious.
I find it impossible to be unbiased, because that Coliseum that you have with the full MCG full of Richmond supporters, there's nothing like it.
That day, we're now switching. We're now switching. Obviously, we didn't intend to go there, but I knew we'd go there eventually. That was a 90,000 strong uninhibited cheer squad.
Mm.
So everyone was wearing colours, and a lot of people weren't reacting the way fans react at a game, where they're just locked on the game, and then arms shoot up for a goal, and then, you know, faces buried in hands during a clangor. The goal would be scored, and then the stadium would bobble like a notion as people would turn to each other, throw a hug around the person next to them, start taking selfies. It was quite a different experience to any other footy experience I've ever had. And when I was reading the audiobook, there was a couple of moments there, and that was one of them, where I teared up, and the second one was the street party after the grand final. When I was rereading that section, funny, they're your own words, and you should be able to plod through them without getting emotional, but it's still too vivid a memory.
Well, I was going to ask, so you tweeted on grand final day a picture of yourself with your mother, which, you know, I went to a game with my brother, and it was clearly, there was both such a strong sense of occasion and of being able to share that occasion with people you really care about, but also, you know, sharing it with complete strangers who'd been on the same journey.
Yeah.
There's nothing quite like it.
Yeah, just after Mum and I'd never been to a grand final before, and I think we've only ever seen Richmond win one final. When we were young, we'd go to the home and away games, but we'd never went to the final series, 72, 73, 74, 75, 77, 80, 82. We didn't go to any of those finals. first final I ever went with her was 95, lost to North Melbourne. And I didn't go to the Essendon game. In fact, I didn't even watch it because I was somewhere else, which probably tells you how, you know, a little disengaged. I was probably coming back, but I was still a little disengaged. My apologies for those who stuck through thick and thin while I was in Canberra, but it was the distance more than the team performance that separated me a little bit from footy. We did see the Carlton final together, 2001, but that was a strange one. That was a strange game because it was in the shadow of, well, in the rubble of September 11, wasn't in its shadow. It just happened. And this was the first mass spectator event in Australia after that event. And you were searching the skies half the time, hoping nothing would come out of them and turn a footy match into something else. But we, as we were wandering up the just past Punt Road on the way to the G, I said to her, just stop for a sec. And she goes, why are we stopping? And I said, just let's take a photo together, share this moment. A little smile. Popped it on Twitter and then turned my Twitter account off for the day because I wasn't going to be distracted at that point. And then snuck a peek at it. And people were asking me, what did she cook for lunch? So she brought some lovely Greek pita for all of us. And again, that was another one of those little generous exchanges. Mm. And you're right, it's not just family, though. So the sort of mingling at the gate, I bumped into a mate of mine, and he's having selfies with random strangers. Mm. He's quite a record store owner, Warwick Brown at Greville Records. If I can plug Greville Records as a tiger sanctuary. Warwick was just having all these blokes come up to him. They'd been to his shop, celebrating with Warwick the fact that Warwick got to go to the grand final with his son. I saw him and said, mate, do you know any of these guys? Nah, just blokes walking up and have a photo with me. And I thought, that's exactly what you described. That's the spirit, the spirit of that particular occasion. A couple of goals into that first quarter, when Adelaide had kicked the first couple of goals, the noise that came back from the Adelaide section was pretty strong.
Yeah.
So it was on. It wasn't the GWS game. It wasn't that, you know, weird marching sort of Russian polka that they put over the loudspeaker to create a sense of mass. They're all AFL officials down the other end wearing orange during the GWS game, weren't they?
Well, I do know people who bought GWS. You can buy zero game GWS members, and they bought them just to get a finals ticket.
As Tiger fans.
As Tiger fans.
Of course. I think Geelong... Geelong people complained that we had a lot of our supporters in their section. Yeah, well, great. You're up our noses in it for 11 years, so you would expect when the lid came off, it would be volcanic. That sense of... And it was all those multiple stories, because you could feel it in the it in the ground. It was multiple stories, not just people's lives. And there were people who were absent too. Because I've heard a couple of stories, people had spare tickets for... People had passed away and the seat was empty next to them. In fact, now I'm tearing up just thinking about that side of it, because it's quite a long life between premierships. There's a couple of generations in there. And if you've maintained the habit of attendance and you passed it on to a kid or a grandkid and they've gone through the misery, I'll give you a Brendan Gale anecdote which didn't appear in the book. Brendan said, even in that all the way through September, and especially after the grand final, all these people his age would come up to him and say, thank you, thank you, thank you. I've been coercing my kids to go to the game for years, and I finally showed them why we were going every year. Because nothing will ever top this experience we've had. Christos's godson, because I saw him the other night, because we had the launch in Melbourne on the Tuesday night. He's only an 18-year-old, and I said, so did you get a ticket? He said he was the only one. He had a ticket. He went on his own, and he went before anyone had even turned up at the ground. He said, absolutely, it was the best day of my life, and I don't expect to ever top it. But there will be some days that will top it. But I'm getting very distracted by the emotion of reliving some of this stuff.
It was a very big day. I had someone just down the aisle from me who just, at the siren, just wasn't coping. And I just went and hugged him. And I almost missed it for the going to the round one game. But I didn't get to hug 20 random strangers in the course of the day. Like,
so just... You've just reminded me of one such a long game. There was a seated in front of us were a group of five or six, and a young guy was the Richmond supporter, and everyone else Geelong supporters. And Geelong team runs out on the ground. Some of our supporters ungraciously boo him. So I thought it was a bit. There was a moment where, ooh, okay, that's weird. This poor kid, he's been frozen out by what may have been his partner or his best friend or whatever. She had back turned to him. He had no one to celebrate with. And at one point, he caught my eye late in the last quarter, you know, when the avalanche started. I gave him the high five, put his arm around him, and I said, mate, what a day. What a day. What a night, as it was.
Well, I think. Look, everyone should buy the book because, you know, what excuse do we need for reliving 2017? But I think one of the things I really enjoyed was the sense of history and trying to place where we are in the context of where we've been.
Yes.
And I'm extremely attracted to the idea that we could be living through to be 1974.
Yeah, that is the question about going back to back is not just, is this 1974? Is this not 1981? So the thing about that 1980 premiership team, the 1980 premiership team looked like the premiership team from about round four. We smashed Collingwood earlier that year, and I remember I went to the Carlton game that year, and we were walking home, I was only 16 then, and everybody was talking about a premiership as they're coming out of the ground. But of course, we won a few by then, and you sort of could strut at that point. Through 74... and I was 10 years old in 1974. It was very clear all year that they were the dominant team. But they also hated in 74. And I think the club enjoyed being hated. I think that was part of the MO in those days. And I think, as I was alluding to earlier, I think it did work in that sort of old VFL model, especially when you've got the ability to be able to get as many good players on your list as possible. So I remember around that time, you know, they weren't quick enough, so they get Paul Sproul. Billy Barrett had sort of, a couple of years earlier, sort of reached the end of his rope at Richmond. You know, his depression was probably undiagnosed at that point, but it was becoming a bit difficult to manage. So they go for Ian Stewart. Neil Baum turns up earlier in that era because they weren't tough enough. And so they were able to recruit up until 74... before Petura, of course, because Petura, it all goes off the rails of Petura. You know, they had the benefit of incumbency and it was reinforcing. This is not 74 in the sense that Richmond is so far more dominant. You know, you don't... I mean, Dustin is Royce Harden away and...
same height.
Same height. Are they exactly the same height, same number? They're built differently, but... And I haven't seen Dustin ever leave the ground going for a mark. In fact, he only ever leaves one leg. You know how one leg sort of goes up, you know, like a crane or something, and that's only to execute a chess mark, a high chess mark, up around the shoulder. They're obviously not as dominant compared to the next team, and they aren't going for their fourth premiership in 7 years. But it does feel like that they've turned up this year. With the "we're going to defend" mindset. I think they turned up in 1981 still celebrating. A bit unlucky in 1981, but they're losing games they shouldn't have lost. We're winning games we shouldn't win this year.
And I think that point about luck's a good one to remember, that you can be the best team and it still not be your day.
Yeah. I think here's where I'd be confident, not so much about whether we'll go back-to-back, but whether... defeat will do to us what, say, defeat did to Adelaide. And I think this is the thing about 2016. I think having come through that and then picked up a premiership the following year, and you can see the way they play, they enjoy each other's company. You know, the HR at that club is world class. People go to work looking forward to going to work. And I spent a bit of time on my night. No, we've won the premiership. I spent a bit of time sort of researching towards the end of that year. I didn't want to have much to do with the players because, you know, that story's been told 100 times. I was more interested in the machinery of how that club remade itself. and everybody seemed very happy to be at work. And they've got the KGI, so they've got that Indigenous Leadership School as well. And you've got all these little Indigenous kids, you know, at their recess and lunch break, having a kick in the park and running in and out of the... It's just... It's a happy place. But for it to be a happy place took a lot of work. And I think because it is a happy place, even if they... Even if their luck runs out this year, I think they'll still go to work next year happy to be together and happy to be playing together. And look, I personally, a premiership would be nice. And we were talking the other night at the launch, and Waleed Ali made this point that if you can guarantee the premiership, you take Collingwood as the runner-up. And in fact, the best-case scenario, I thought, was if you... Because I wouldn't be able to handle the stress of a Richmond Collingwood grand final not knowing the result. I've got to be honest about that. But if you knew that you could win a premiership against Collingwood, you'd hope that they knocked off the team that should have won the premiership in the preliminary final. They did you the ultimate favour. You know, pinched one off a GWS or pinched one off the West Coast.
Or Melbourne.
There's a good question about Melbourne, by the way. They haven't been in the final. This list hasn't been in the final before. What is the precedent for turning up in the first year and winning a premiership cold, Richmond 1967. They had no prior... Well, half of them weren't even born. Well, not half of them, but a few of them hadn't even been born. Royce Hart certainly hadn't been born at the time of the last finals appearance. And half that list had only known the MCG as their home ground. The other half had obviously played during the dark days at Punt Road. So maybe Melbourne can do it. But Melbourne haven't beaten anyone in the eight, have they?
No, once... They've got one win against a top eight team.
Yeah. Worst case scenario. Let's talk worst case scenario. We get them in the first week. And they go nuts.
Yeah, and their ruckman's 6'10".
And they go nuts.
And Clayton Oliver's really good.
Yeah, and Hogan has a day out. And then we have to... I mean, we have to go via the Cape to get to a grand final. So we would then have to win the second one at home, which we probably would. But maybe because we're on the other side of the door, maybe we've got West Coast in the preliminary or GWS in the preliminary. Okay. It gets harder, doesn't it?
It does.
You could just see that. They could be a little off on a day. They
can kick for goal badly. Jason Castagna can kick for goal very badly.
Oh, no, he's turned it around. He kicked a ridiculous goal against Geelong. But then, of course, he sprayed that one on the left foot. He had no idea what he was doing on his left side, did he?
Quick, I have a theory that quick players are almost incapable of kicking on their wrong foot because they've never had to at juniors.
Yeah. Hey, Jack Higgins, let's talk about Jack Higgins. Can we talk about Jack Higgins for a second?
We can talk about...
any one of them.
Any one of them. So, was it a throw?
No, absolutely not. So, was that goal that McCartan kicked Sydney against Collingwood the other week, was that a throw? He was lying on his back when he slung it onto his boot.
I think so as well. And yeah. I'm actually a qualified AFL umpire, but I was thinking, you can throw it in the air for the purpose of kicking it, but you can't literally throw it over somebody's head and then kick it.
No, you can't do that. That is in basketball a double movement, right?
That would be taking it too far. But no, I think. And when also when you think about some of the great moments like the Ablett mark against Collingwood, I think you've just got to err on the side of the football.
Football
is entertainment that we are all better off for these supreme moments in our
lives.
But
it was the one action. Clearly he threw the ball out in front of him. I was thinking of a couple of our older players with those really high ball tossy kind of ball drops. So Robert McGee, the ball is suspended. Like a balloon for about 2 seconds before he kicks it. There used to be, when I used to play footy, there used to be guys who didn't, well, kids, those were then the taller ones, who actually didn't know how to kick a football, and they'd throw it and then hoik it, like catapult it. So it's not like people haven't done that before. But there was only, that was the most amazing thing about that. This is why you couldn't deny Jack that goal. His brain was working all the time, and he assessed that I had to flick it back out and then kick it around the corner.
Yeah, the problem solving's incredible in the moment.
Yeah, and he had a set shot against Geelong the following week, and he was all fidgety, and he didn't know, but he was only 30 metres out, and you could see he was going to miss it. We were down that end, and you could see he was going to miss it. And the only player I've seen Well, Richo was always, you know, anywhere between 0 and 35 metres, he was going to miss that. And he had this weird pocket where, because the way the ball would hook off his foot, it was a bit of a J-curve in his kicking action. He, outside 50, on the wrong side.
On an angle.
He'd nail it. And you knew he'd nail it, and he'd be celebrated even before he kicked it. The only other person...
The end result was that Richo was a completely average goal kicker.
Yeah.
60%. Completely league average.
Yeah, and absolutely. I would understand that because there was a lot more heroics than fluff shots. But everybody would rip in at infinitum the fluff shot. But Jack Higgins, there's one guy from another team that he reminds me of, but even though they're completely different build and completely different mindset. Gary Ablett Sr. struggled conceptually with a short distance set shot because he couldn't recreate the long bomb. He couldn't recreate the sort of elegant lope because it's standing start and he had to regenerate his momentum. So I used to play a fair bit of tennis, and there was always a particular kind of player, and you knew this guy who made you could feed off a good player's speed and power, but the guy who served you junk and just flicked junk back over the net at you, that wily old customer forced you to almost reinvent your ground stroke to reassert yourself and to do it from a standing start. And this is something that Jack Higgins seems to struggle with at the moment. I hope he doesn't overthink it though.
He needs a routine that he can fall back on.
Yeah, that replicates because in the moment he's as intuitive a footballer as I've seen.
I know. It makes me sad that we'll never see the 2017 Premiership team play together again, but I'm extremely happy he's part of the team.
Well, him and Jaden Short. Mm. Okay, so we're going to be missing two, and we might even find a way for the Truro man to get him conquered into that team.
Mm.
Like, how good would that be?
That would be fantastic. And the word is he's close to coming back.
Yeah, but who are the three that miss out?
It's like picking between children at this stage.
It is, unfortunately. Mm. And you don't want it to be because of injury. But three guys will... If Conker comes back, three guys from that Premiership team will have to miss out. So pleased to see Townsend back.
Mm.
He's not a footballer. He's a rugby league player, but...
He is. But he's such a selfless player as well. And I think he's... Just the fabric of the team works with him in it. But he's marginally talented. So.
Tough
decisions.
He plays within his... do we need another ruck?
Collingwood's a problem.
So when Nankervis was off the ground for about 10 minutes, we didn't see the ball. I mean, the back line held up. But of course... If that's your plan A, to be on the receiving end of a clearance, that is no way to win a premiership. I would assume they're aware of this. I mean, you know.
They're smart people and they worry about these things.
And I assume that as the reigning premier, you know, you wouldn't be declaring your hand in round four.
Mm.
And the teams that have tried to bounce on their way to back-to-back, you know, Collingwood 2011, Geelong 2008. Part of trying to be perfect from the start was almost asking for trouble at the other end.
Mm.
Funny, you know, it was only this time last year I started thinking of the multiple final scenarios. Even though I'd had a gut feel that they'd win it, I was still enjoying going to the game every week. But then towards the end of the year, firstly, secure top four. Secondly, who are we going to get? So you're watching the other results in the first week, because we didn't have to go to Adelaide first week. But by getting third and getting Geelong in the first week, you know, the seas had parted for us, hadn't they?
I know. Well, it's such a different experience this year that we'll have, assuming we beat Gold Coast and beat them well, we're locked into top spot while this death match is happening for
all
positions.
Around
us. Two
through,
right?
Yeah, except the problem with those death matches is they were our death matches last year, and one of them could go on a roll.
Mm.
As I think it through, strangely, Melbourne might be the one.
Mm. I know.
It doesn't look like a West Coast or GWS are going to be able to put their best team on the park.
No, especially if Toby Green's injured, that's a big loss.
I think we'd fancy ourselves against GWS. Yeah. I don't think we were coasting in that game at Spotless, but I think they surprised themselves that they could play that badly and almost beat them at home.
And Spotless is the smallest ground in the league, so it's the opposite of the MCG in terms of style of play.
Yeah, poor old Castagna, eh? That game. That's a disaster, that game.
Look, George, you've been very generous with your time.
Thank you very much.
So thanks for speaking with the audience, and I'd urge everyone to read the book for all the good reasons you've mentioned. But anything Richmond at the moment, I think.
Absolutely. Get yourself a souvenir and then pretend if we win again that I wrote about 2018 instead of 2017. There's a bit more than just 2017 in this book.
Well, thanks very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.